Good morning, everyone. I hope that you got some rest last night and are ready to punch through this last few weeks until holidays. What I'd like to do today is talk about three different categories of issues as per DSM. We're going to talk about, just very briefly, gender dysphoria, talk about dysfunctions of sexuality, and then we're going to talk about sexual deviancies, in other words, the paraphilias. So to start, gender dysphoria. You'll notice that this has a lot of different terms over the years, and even DSM has changed its mind about what label this should be called. In the previous edition, it was called gender identity disorder. Now it's called gender dysphoria. What's the basis for this change in name? What you'll notice is that what did they drop from the name? Disorder. They're trying to use this more as a description, a descriptive term for someone's discontentment if they happen to have some sort of incompatibility between their anatomical sex and what they view as their psychological sense of being male or female. So this incongruence isn't necessarily the issue. The problem is if you're upset about it, if you're dysphoric about the fact that you have the anatomy of one sex, but you have the psychological sense of being the other. So disorder was dropped from the name, just to emphasize that this is just a description. Then there was discussion about why do we even, if we're dropping the name disorder and it's a description of someone's experience, why is it in the DSM at all? And DSM argued that said, well, you know what? People that have distress about this incompatibility, the treatment that's involved can be quite costly and lengthy. And if we took it out of the manual, then it actually might be detrimental to the person because they might not get coverage for the type of management that they would desire. So that was the rationale for leaving this descriptive term in. But it does refer to someone who at a very, very young age, typically, and usually it's age 2, age 3, age 4, when that sense of gender identity is established, that they really have this marked discrepancy between what their anatomy says and what their psychological sense says. And I don't know if you're familiar, how much you're familiar with the case of Jazz Jennings, but she's gotten a lot of notoriety over the years, a lot of publicity. She's a spokeswoman for transgender people. But what got her first known was the fact that her parents decided when she was a very young girl that they were going to let her interface as a girl, even though anatomically she was a boy. She was maybe 3 when they said, geez, our son is so distressed about having to act like a boy and dress like a boy that, okay, at home, we'll let our son interact as a girl. And then even by age 5, the distress and sadness and, oh, I don't even want to go to my own birthday party if I can't wear a dress. And finally, the parents made the decision, okay, even at school, to the world, you're going to open up as a girl. And she got interviewed by Barbara Walters on 2020 News Show, and that brought Jazz to public light. And then she started her own reality TV show. You can watch her as she ages and the trials and tribulations of being an adolescent, let alone a transgender adolescent. But she was one, again, at a very young age, was saying, don't call me a he, I'm a she. God made a mistake. I'm a girl, not a boy. When is God going to change his mistake? When is he going to fix it? This doesn't belong here. And here's the toenail clippers and trying to make the own rectification to genitalia that didn't belong there in this very young kid's mind. So it's very persistent, very strong disharmony, discrepancy. You already from earlier lecture today from Dr. Blackman talked about sexually dimorphic nuclei and gender. So I've left this in your notes just to be consistent, but I'm not going to go over the same information that you just received earlier about sexually dimorphic nuclei and hormone exposure. What I want to focus on is if someone experiences distress because their anatomy is not what they feel they should have, what do you do? Is talk therapy going to talk them out of it? No. Chances are what will make them not dysphoric anymore is actually changing the way they interface with the world, changing their anatomy as much as they can so that their psychological sense of being masculine, feminine is consistent with their body. And as what Jazz did, it again, started off very young, acting as a girl, dressing like a girl, referring to herself as a girl. And then once you hit puberty, what do you need to do? You got to stop the natural hormones from kicking in and developing penis size and all these secondary male characteristics that she doesn't want. And they put her on male hormone suppression drugs. And at the same time, as you're suppressing puberty, stalling in a way to make sure that this is a persistent desire, that Jazz isn't going to change her mind, they stall, and at some point they say, okay, we've stalled enough, let's start developing female secondary sex characteristics. So here comes some estrogen treatment and so forth. Some people are content with developing the secondary sex characteristics and then interfacing as the gender that is consistent with their psychological sense. But some want to go that very last step and have what I've just learned the term bottom surgery. And at first I thought, bottom surgery? But they're referring to basically changing genitalia, your vaginoplasty or phalloplasty. And I just watched on YouTube yesterday, Jazz being consulting with a plastic surgeon who specializes in transgender medicine because she wants to have her basically penis amputated and then have a vagina created. And the whole discussion with the parents and the doctor about this process. So really, management of gender dysphoria is helping their body transition to the gender that is consistent with their psychological sense. Next, totally different chapter, we're referring to problems with the sexual response cycle. Something is wrong with sexual interest. Something's wrong with why you can't get physiologically aroused or sustain your physiological arousal. Why can't you orgasm? So these are problems that pertain to sexual responsiveness, and the names that are associated with these are fairly straightforward, makes sense, that if you're a female, you could have problems with sexual libido. Just, I'm not interested. I got zero interest. You can also have more extreme where it's not just I'm apathetic about it, I'm averse to it. It's revolting, disgusting. Still gives you the same diagnosis. If it's a problem with sexual arousal, whether it's lack of interest or even aversion to it, it would get that female sexual interest arousal disorder. And similarly, what if you're like, in theory, I've got fantasy, I'm kind of interested, but then when it comes down to sexual activity, physiologically, you're not getting prepared for sexual intercourse. And oftentimes, that's a matter of vaginal lubrication not working. That would be same category of problem. Then you have someone who might get physiologically aroused. They have interest or aroused, but for some reason, they're not able to orgasm. So we have a term for that problem. Then if you have problems with pain, whether it's pain during intercourse, pain touching the vulva, just pain surrounding vaginal intercourse, then this could be a diagnosis, the GPPPD label. Now, the penetration disorder also is say that someone has muscle spasm, basically, of the vagina, that the vaginal muscles contract and it prevents insertion of penis or speculum or whatever else. You get the GPPD label. In the past, DSM recognized officially two different terms to capture what we're now calling GPPPD. The dyspareunia was the term that said you have pain, genital pain, basically. That could be male or female. Then we had vaginismus, which was the involuntary muscular contractions upon attempted penetration. Although DSM has purged those terms as actual diagnoses, gynecologists still use the term, physicians still use the term dyspareunia and vaginismus. So there's still good vocabulary words to know, even if DSM decided not to use them anymore. In the male domain, certainly men can have low libido, and that can be diagnosed. They can have problems with maintaining or sustaining an erection, and they can have problems with orgasm. In the case of men, though, they recognize not just an inordinate difficulty orgasming, but they also recognize orgasming too quickly. We don't have that with women. They don't say that's a problem, apparently. But with men, they say it's a problem if you orgasm too quickly. Okay. when you note that someone has, and again, with all these labels that I've described, the underlying assumption is that there's a psychological contribution to why sexual responsiveness isn't occurring as naturally as we would expect. So that's how it winds up in a psychiatric manual. We want to indicate sort of the context in which the problem occurs. Is it in all contexts or only in some contexts? So for some people, I have no problems with erections if I'm masturbating, but if I'm with another person or my wife, I have problems. So you want to know whether it's a generalized or context-specific or situational problem. I also want to know, have you ever been able to orgasm? Or is this something that's just now started? So that type of extra description is usually noted if you're going to give these labels. What type of psychological contributions could be affecting sexual responsiveness? And I've listed a couple of things here, but you know, yes, you could feel this is sinful. I've heard my whole life sex is bad, and now that I've got the opportunity, now I'm so feeling guilty that it's impairing my functioning. Or maybe I'm worried that I'm not very skilled, or I'm not that pleased with the way my body looks, and I'm wondering if my partner is going to find me attractive. Or maybe I'm worried about pregnancy. Maybe I'm worried about sexually transmitted infection. What is it that is stopping you from having natural sexual responsiveness? Stress certainly can interfere, as you've already learned, with sexual responsivity. So even if you might have a medical condition that the physician might say, yeah, that might cause some of the difficulties that you're having, we still think that there's a psychological contributor to why you're having problems in this domain. If you're going to diagnose it as per DSM, the assumption is there's some contribution of psychological factors. How do you recognize that someone has a sexual dysfunction? Imagine yourself as a physician and you are interviewing a patient. They come in for just a routine examination. Are you going to actually say, so, are you sexually active? Are you satisfied with your sex life? Do you think that would be part of your normal history? It is supposed to be, but I just know from my years going to doctors, that's not what they tend to do. They don't necessarily ask how things are going in that aspect of your life. The recommendation is that it should just be incorporated as part of your routine history taking. And you even say, I'm going to ask you some personal questions about your sexual activity, sexual life. I ask this of all my patients because I just want to make sure I'm providing the best care possible. So you want to do it in a regular routine way with no assumptions and no biases. So it's not assuming you're heterosexual, assuming you're homosexual, assuming you're sexually active. It's who are you attracted to? Men, women, both, neither? I mean, you put it out there and you try not to show any sort of bias or judgment about what your expectations are. And you've already familiarized yourself with the difference in terms. A lot of people, when you say, what's your sexual preference or sexual orientation, some people don't recognize what that means compared to what someone's gender identity is. So hopefully you have a good understanding now that if you say, what's your sexual orientation, that has to do with sexual attraction. It doesn't have to do with the psychological sense of being male or female. It's very different. Now, what if you do what you're supposed to do? You ask your sexual history. You say, are you sexually active? Yes. How's it going? Are you satisfied? No. Well, what's going on? And what are the things if they say, yes, I have problems with arousal, I have problems orgasming, I have problems even with interest in sex, I just have low sex drive. It could be a psychological diagnosis, it could be a psychological problem, or there's many other things that could interfere with your sexual responsiveness. Certainly knowing what medications they're on, and we've already said that drugs like Prozac, fluoxetine, are culprits oftentimes with both men and women affecting your sexual responsiveness. Antihypertensives apparently are very known for having sexual side effects. So it's good to find out what medications they're on and see if that might be what's contributing to their problem. So prescription meds, even non-prescription drugs like our benzodiazepines, alcohol, any of our sedative drugs tend to disrupt sexual responsiveness. If you had diabetes, for example, menopause, some things might be contributing to why all of a sudden you're having difficulties in responsiveness. And maybe the problem that you're experiencing is because you're now 65 years old or 60 years old or 55 years old, and things change as you age. And it's important for, I think, both partners to understand the changes so that, well, one, people are nervous about, why is it that you're taking so long to get an erection? You used to get an erection in a heartbeat when I put on this outfit, and now you're thinking I'm not attractive, you're not aroused by me, and all of a sudden now you're stressed, and stress is making things worse. So finding out that over time with age, yeah, it will take longer to get erections. Even the quality of orgasms tend to be a little bit diminished, maybe not as intense. How long it takes you after an orgasm to be able to orgasm again. It's not 10 minutes like when you were 20. It could be 24 hours. And knowing that this is part of aging maybe can reduce some of the stress and concern about sexual relations. Also, it might be important if someone especially says, I'm having problems with erections. I have erectile dysfunction. Well, is that psychological or is there something else going on? And the snap gauge test you might have already learned about, but it capitalizes on the fact that when men are in REM sleep, they have erections. If you have erections during REM sleep, then you know that if you're having problems with erections during daytime, it means that if you are having erections during your sleep and you're not able to do it during waking life, it means that it's probably more psychological. But if you're not having erections during REM sleep, then your problems during the day are probably not psychological. So how do we know? How do we know if you're having erections during the sleep? Well, the snap gauge, postage stamps that you can put around your penis. It's basically, before you go to bed, flaccid penis, put this gauge around it. And if you had penile tumescence, if you had a change in penis circumference in the night, that is, you had an erection, that gauge will be snapped open in the morning. So you know you had one. You know that physiologically things are working. So if you're having problems in daytime with people, then it might be more psychological. What do we do to manage someone with sexual dysfunction? Dual sex therapy is sort of the catchphrase for several different techniques that are involved with treating people who have dysfunctions. Masters and Johnson, known for promoting this technique, but it was basically saying, if you can treat both partners, if there are partners, not just a single person identified, you treat both partners, hence dual sex therapy. And one of the major aspects of dual sex therapy is homework assignments. And your homework assignments are basically, you have a sex menu. These are the items on the menu this week. These are the items you're allowed to do on date night. And you live by this menu, you cannot break the menu. And at first, for someone who's having problems with lubricating, having problems getting erections, having problems orgasming, there's a lot of stress and you know, you just want to avoid sex. I don't even want to go there because it's so frustrating and makes me feel so bad. So oftentimes this sex menu says what? You are allowed to what on date night? Hold hands, arm around the shoulder, maybe rub their lower back. I mean, it's very prescribed about what you're allowed to do. Expectations are in place. You are not expected to have sex. You're not expected to have an erection. You're not expected to do anything. What you're supposed to do is start to enjoy the sense of touch. So sensate focus, focus on the pleasurable sensation without all the stress of having to perform. And over time, if you go slowly and gradually, you can add more activities back onto your sex menu up to the point where dessert can be added back on and you're going to do all the things that you might always want to do. But it's very gradual to learn to like sensations again in the intimate realm. So that's a huge aspect of dual sex therapy. Reduce the stress, learn to enjoy the sensations again, and work your way back up. Other behavioral type of techniques that you could use. If you, for example, had the premature ejaculation, one way to inhibit that would be to, as the person is about to orgasm, that the partner will apply pressure to a painful extent to the head of the penis, and that aversiveness should cause the erection to subside. Alternatively, instead of doing something so aversive to the partner, instead, as the person feels like they're going to prematurely ejaculate, that you could stop sensations, cover up, no more dirty talking, whatever it is, remove the stimuli. And you'll still hear about these techniques on step one. How do you treat these? So even though they might not be used so much today, they're still talked about on the board. So be familiar with those aspects of treating premature ejaculation. Also, why would a drug like Prozac be used to treat premature ejaculation? What's its side effect? Sexual dysfunction. It impairs interest. It impairs erections. It impairs orgasm. That's what we want to do, in a way, is slow it down. So the SSRIs could be prescribed to capitalize on those side effects. Plisset. This is not a treatment, it's a strategy. It's your overall reminder of, what do I do if someone actually has a sexual dysfunction? What's my course of action? The P part is basically what you're conforming to when you ask about their sexual history. Are you satisfied? Any problems in that domain? Because by asking about it, it's saying it's okay to acknowledge that I'm having problems in this area. And by asking about it, it's saying perhaps there's a way to fix it. So just remember to ask about their sexual life. If they do endorse the fact that they have sexual dysfunction, your first reaction shouldn't be, well, I'm not a specialist, I'm going to refer you on. Your first reaction should be, let's talk about and think about some things we can do. And you can provide some basic information. If they're saying, yeah, I'm just having problems having erections now, and maybe it's their level of stress is huge, and you can describe, you know, that stress inhibits sexual responsiveness, and it could just be their high level of stress. Maybe the reason why the woman isn't having an orgasm is because there isn't enough clitoral stimulation, and clitoral stimulation tends to be quite required for orgasm, and maybe it's just a matter of different positions and different strategies. Okay. They can try, if that's not useful, then perhaps saying, how about do the sex menu, dual sex therapy approach? Try the start and stop technique. Try an SSRI. So you have some basic strategies you could recommend. And then if those don't work, then maybe they do need more specialized attention. So PLIS is just your overall strategy for treating someone who's endorsing a sexual dysfunction. So for the last bit, let's talk about the deviancies. These are the people who have sexual responsiveness. They get sexually excited. But it's the stimulus, the object, that is causing the excitement that is problematic. What is normal sexual? What should we normally get excited to? Because we have to define that before we can say what's deviant sexual interest. DSM's definition. And what they're trying to emphasize, that what is normal then is, one, they have to be human. They have to be consenting, which is kind of getting at the fact they should be an adult. So human, adult, alive is probably the key for being someone normal. And then most things beyond that would be on the deviant side. Now notice, they are the first ones to say there's a lot of things that can be sexually arousing. And it could be, now para is just sort of beyond, sort of on the outskirts of, it's kind of out there as far as being sexually attracted to or sexually arousing. So a lot of things can arouse you. We can say you have a paraphilia. Okay, not a problem. But do you have a paraphilic disorder? So when does your sexual arousal for something that's a little bit on the fringe become a disorder? And DSM says, well, three situations that we're going to say whatever your sexual excitement is about, it's a disorder if whatever that is, urge is, and you have acted on it with someone who never consented to it, that's a disorder, period. Second situation is, what if they're consenting adults? I'm a masochist, he's a sadist, we like hurting each other and getting aroused by one being hurt and the other one by hurting. Isn't that consensual, adult? How is that ever a disorder? The sadist, the masochist, how is that ever a disorder? And DSM says it still could be, even if you're voluntarily engaging in this as an adult. What if you're resulting in serious injuries because of this? Even though it was consenting, the fact that it's resulting in hospitalizations and broken bones and asphyxiation, then they're saying consensual or not, it's a problem. it's a problem. So the distress, functional impairment, serious harm. Then DSM even says, what if you have those deviant urges, but you've never even acted on them? You've never hurt anyone. You've never been hurt and got, it's just all more imaginal. It's fantasy. Can that be a problem? DSM says yes. It depends on how distressed you are, how much of your day spent thinking about it and fantasizing about it. So even if you've never acted on it, you still could have a paraphilic disorder. Okay, so let's see if this person has a paraphilic disorder. Very good. I hope that most of you recognize that when, yes, there's some sexual deviancy to it, but is it a disorder? Is it problematic enough? She's not acting on her urges. But does it seem like it's a, at least, what suggests that it's problematic to say it's a disorder? She's getting help for it. She's worried about what she might end up doing, and the fact that she goes and gets mental health help for it suggests that it's meeting the threshold for this is distressful to her and likely would be best captured as a paraphilic disorder, even though she hasn't acted on it yet. DSM recognizes 8 specific deviancies. Does DSM recognize there's many, many more odd things that people can be sexually attracted to doing and doing? Yes. But what would we call it if it doesn't fit one of these? We'd say it would be an unspecified paraphilic disorder. But they recognize these just because they're the more identifiable ones that come to our attention. So very, very briefly, the exhibitionist is the person who flashes their genitalia to someone who is not expecting to see a genitalia. And then the flasher, the exhibitionist, is actually sort of hoping for that favorable response, which they normally don't get. But they're fantasizing and they're masturbating at the same. It can be very, very scary to the person who is the recipient of this sight, because they're wondering, could they be assaulted? Could they be grabbed? And the typical flasher doesn't try to do anything other than, again, get a reaction from them, but they don't usually try to touch you or grab you in any way. The voyeur is the person who gets sexually aroused by watching someone who doesn't know they're being watched, having sex or naked. DSM just added this added requirement that you have to be an adult before we're going to say you're a voyeur. Why? When you're 16 and you're looking in on through windows and peeping in at your sister or the locker room, what is this? Curiosity. This is adolescent curiosity. You'll wonder what goes on. So DSM wanted to make it very clear that there is interest in what goes on when people are in the other room having sex. But it's not voyeurism unless you're an adult and it's persistent enough. So normal curiosity won't get you the voyeurism. Fetishism. Oh boy, I hate questions during this lecture. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Notice my rapid pace. No time to ask you that. Oh, if they're taking pictures and you know, that's actually a good question, because exhibitionism has always been exposing your, it's always been live. Now it doesn't have to be live. It can be, as you said, through electronic means. I would have to actually see if you could qualify if you were doing that by sending your genitalia virtually to other people. It is a good question. It's a good question. We have to keep up with modern technology if we're with this kind of thing. But it's a good question. Okay, fetish. No, go ahead. Well, it's not part of the diagnosis. If you're doing it for sexual arousal, period. So it's not required that you're doing it to get the, but that's usually why they're doing it, is they're doing it because they want the shock value, they want the excitement, they want the reaction. Okay, relating back to that, if you did it over the phone, could you get the, well, it's not requirement that they get the reaction. The requirement is only that you get sexually aroused by showing your genitalia to unsuspecting people. Whether you get the reaction or not is not essential to the diagnosis. It's just usually part of what happens. A fetish. When do we say we have a fetish? Now, a lot of us are like, oh, I really like those red spiky shoes you wear. That really gets me sexually excited. Is that a fetish? No, that's why we buy these things. We want to make our partner sort of sexually aroused. When does it become a fetish? It becomes a fetish when that object is required. I need you to wear that or it's not happening for me. Or I don't even need you, I just want the object itself. And to give you an example, this was a case that was written up to show you the intensity. This guy had a rubber boot fetish. I always seem to have been fascinated by rubber boots. I cannot say exactly when the fascination first started, but it must have been when I was young. The spell is almost hypnotic, and should I see someone walking around with rubber boots, I become very excited and may follow the person for a great distance. I quickly get an erection under such circumstances, and I might easily ejaculate. Then he talks about, I will often take rubber boots to bed with me, caress them, kiss them, and ejaculate into them. That is fetish quality, not just, ooh, I like your... All right, so fetish. Transvestism. This is when someone is dressing up as the opposite sex for the sole intent of getting sexual arousal. This is not someone like Jazz who's dressing like a girl because she believes she's a girl, she feels she's a girl, she's dressing as a girl. That's not sexual arousal. If I dress up like a man and I'm getting paid to be a performer, that's not transvestism. Transvestism is you are doing this cross-gender dressing for the sake, because that sexually arouses you. That's when you use that term. Frotteurism. The frotteur is someone who rubs up against someone, again, usually not suspecting, and they're rubbing their genitalia up against you for sexual excitement. So the typical context would be the crowded subways, buses, dance halls, wherever it is, where the person actually will rub their genitalia up against you and then sort of disappear into the crowd. Okay? So it's sexual assault. These people often do sort of plan this. So for example, there was this case that was written up where the guy says, yeah, I've been doing this 10 years. I've probably rubbed up against 1,000 women. And what I do is before I go to the subway and figure out the one that I wanted to rub against, I'll take plastic wrap it around my penis so that when I do ejaculate, when I rub up against the person, I don't stain my clothes and therefore I can just go to work. Yeah, that is compulsive sexual deviancy. That's a frotter. Sadism, masochism. Keep in mind that the sadist is the person who gets the sexual arousal from inflicting harm. And it's not fake harm, it's real harm. It is burning you, it is really hitting you. It's not just the slap, like little slap. This is being punched. This is being throttled. This is bruise marks. This is asphyxiation. Sadism is causing true, true harm. Does it have to be physical? Can it be psychological harm? Yep, they can be quite demeaning. I want you to basically live in this doghouse, wear a collar, eat like a dog, bark like a dog, and that sexually arouses the sadist. The masochist would be the person who is getting sexually aroused by being demeaned, by being physically hurt. That is what they find really uniquely sexually aroused, is actually receiving the, whether it's psychological or physical, pain. Pedophilia. This is the person who gets excited by a child who hasn't gone through puberty yet. Now, that's obviously going to vary from person to person, their age of puberty, but in general, DSM says if the kid's 13 years or younger, that's probably pedophilia, but it really depends on whether this kid is gone through puberty or not. So the pedophile is really getting at someone, not just who has sex or is offensive to a minor, this is someone who's young, like prepubescent. DSM does also recognize that, well, when you're 13, 12, 14, there's some issues in age. So they do have this requirement that if we're going to call you a pedophile, you must be 16, and there's got to be an age differential of at least 5 years. Then we would call it pedophilia. So is this person a pedophile? So in this case, it's kind of, well, is the kid prepubescent or not? Do we even need to know? We don't really even need to know because we know the age of the offender and we know the age of the, if we want to say victim, of the kid, the girl. And you don't have the age requirement of the perpetrator, and we don't have the differential between the perpetrator and the victim. So it's not pedophilia, at least DSM world. So what I would probably do is first get the description for the paraphilia. The paraphilia being described is masochism. No doubt about it, it's what masochism is about, getting sexually excited by being, at least in theory, hurt. Is it a disorder? Oh, we debated whether this is a disorder or not. For those of you who put disorder, why? Yeah, right there in the vignette, it's telling you it is disruptive to her life. She's about ready to get fired because she's engaging in the fantasy so much. So she doesn't have to act on it to be disordered. Remember, that was a permutation of when you can diagnose a paraphilic disorder is not necessarily where they act on it, but whether it's disruptive to your life. And this is definitely disruptive to her life. She's at risk for losing her job. So it would qualify as a disorder. What do we know causes deviancy? We don't. We don't know what causes it. There's a lot of hypothesizing just based on the fact that most people who have a paraphilia are men. Most people who, and it's because it's so sexual in nature that they're thinking, okay, testosterone has to be involved. Doesn't it seem like sex drive and men seems like it should be a role of this hormone? And yet we can't really show that there's too high levels, too low levels, too, but there's still the suggestion that something's gone wrong with testosterone, even though we don't have anything tangible to support that. We also suspect that impulse control is compromised. We know frontal lobes very rich in serotonergic connections. We know serotonin's really good for impulse control. And here's someone who is very impulsive. They're someone that, even though they know they can go to jail, they're violating parole, they're doing it again. So they're not able to put on the brakes. So the assumption is frontal lobe's not doing its job, and there's dysregulation of serotonin. There's also some suggestion that some of the behaviors in paraphilias are learned, and classical conditioning we'll get to later this week or tomorrow. This association that might take place, where let's say a child, a little boy, gets spanked for being misbehaving, and during the spanking, and harsh spanking, that while the kid's kind of flailing, getting spanked over mom's knee, that penis is getting rubbed. And the kid actually is finding the rubbing up against his pants as the kid's getting spanked arousing, but is getting paired with the pain. And so now here's someone that's associated sexual arousal with receiving pain. Is that how you develop this predilection for that particular sensation, in this case pain? Do you start getting excited by underwear because underwear was associated with sexual arousal when you were looking through lingerie magazines? Is there some sort of connection between your sexual responsiveness naturally and then having it associated with some other situation, such that that situation becomes what elicits your arousal? What do we do to treat someone with a sexual deviancy? Well, one approach would be aversion therapy. So it's a type of behavior. Remember, behavioral therapy is doing something. Well, in this case, the doing is you get excited about it. You think about your sexual deviancy, and then we will, in this case, apply something noxious, apply something aversive. So in aversion therapy, it would be, if you get excited by this scenario, you're now getting shocked. If you get excited by this scenario now, you're getting nauseous because we've paired it with, we've given you a drug to make you nauseous, and then we show you pictures of the situation. Think about your sexually deviant act, and now this horrible odor is emitted. And so again, trying to somehow punish the sexual deviancy. So you can do this overtly, or there's a process called covert sensitization in which it's more imaginal. And imaginal would be, for example, this is someone who has, he was in the Marine Corps and then got discharged. He had a transvestic fetish. So he was dressing up as the opposite sex and getting sex up. He wanted treatment for this. So what he was supposed to do is imagine as vividly as you can engaging in that behavior. So he was imagining putting on the makeup and the wig and the clothes and fondling himself and getting excited. And so he's trying to imagine the situation, but then have negative consequences. So what are negative consequences of having gotten all dolled up as the opposite sex, being all sexually aroused, fondling yourself, and then driving off to the bar that you're going to go to? What's a negative consequence? Getting pulled over by the police, and then harassed, made fun of, and in this case, having everyone make fun of you, having your coworkers find out, having your spouse, if you have a spouse, find out, kids crying, wife threatening to leave you, but supposed to imagine the negative consequences. But again, imaginally. Some I read yesterday were like, well, you could also have them imagine, like if they were the exhibitionist, that their penis got caught in their zipper when they were pulling their pants back up. I thought, well, that might be aversive enough to think about. So covert sensitization. Now that in of itself, how effective do you think this will be over in the short term? Well, we use behavioral therapy. We use these approaches a lot to get rid of unwanted behavior, and then maybe the behaviors go down. But what happens when you don't get punished, when you don't come back for therapy for months and months? Probably you're going to forget that used to be associated with punishment of some sort and likely revert. Oftentimes what happens is, especially for repeat offenders, that you're going to be put on some medications. Now, SSRIs, again, that would be the whole idea of, well, two. One would be, can it increase our impulse control? Two, we also know SSRIs are used for OCD type of problems. We also know that it impairs sexual arousal. So maybe this would be a drug that could help with the impulsivity and just with some sexual, and give you some sexual dysfunction, so to speak. The antiandrogens, what we would say, because we don't surgically castrate, but chemically castrate. Can we make it seem as if you were castrated? And Depo-Provera is the drug that's usually used to chemically castrate men. Yes, it's birth control for women, but in men, it does suppress testosterone to the point where the person would be functioning at about if you're 8 years old and your level of testosterone when you're eight, it really puts you back pre-pubertally. And the thought is, if you cut your testosterone, what do you cut? Sex drive. If you cut sex drive, you don't have sexual deviancy. So it's not fixing the problem, but it is controlling the problem, especially in cases in which you're talking about illegal, uncontrolled, repetitive behavior, that this might be what needs to be done. And you can do all the behavioral therapy you want on top of it, but this might be essential. So there's a judgment call with this one. First of all, you have to recognize some of these treatments are irrelevant to a paraphilia. He's got a paraphilia. What paraphilia? Frotteurism. Okay, so start and stop's irrelevant, sensates irrelevant, dual sex irrelevant. But should you use some sort of behavioral therapy? Or do you think this would warrant actually a drug-induced puberty state? And I think if this is the fourth time he's been arrested, this is sexual assault. This is one where are you hoping that if you do this and you get a bad odor that you're going to stop doing this? This is one where I think Depo-Provera, an antiandrogen, would probably be more warranted. And some of the legal systems, and I know California was one, was upon your second offense, you're mandated to be on this drug. So repeated illegal assaultive behavior probably be best controlled with one that you know it's going to work. Behavioral therapy, is it really going to work and how long? This is going to work. Okay, and the last concept I want to leave you with is that people that have deviancies likely would qualify as a sex offender. Now, sex offender is a legal determination. I could urinate in public and I'm a sex offender. That's probably not going to get me a paraphilic diagnosis, but sex offender is more of a legal determination. You know, someone said that they ran through ran through the football field naked in the night on a Saturday, and they got caught, and indecent exposure, and they were labeled as a sex offender. So you have to be concerned about what the definition of sex offender is in your state. But if you're a sex offender, and most of our paraphiliacs would be sex offenders, have to register with the local authorities. Where do you live? And you need to be tracked. And not only do you have to register, but where you live is actually public knowledge. So let's go to New York. And we're going to go to, Ralph. You promised me I could show my things. My internet's not showing. Okay, for the sake of time, I have a backup plan because I'm neurotic. I made screenshots, I'm doing my screenshots. So this isn't perfect, but it's not live internet. This is a screenshot. But you see a whole bunch of people. This was a search by the county Bronx. And the pages went on and on and on and on. Now, then, I'm just going to improvise. I'm sort of out of time. What's happening? What is going on? Okay. What you would see if this was functioning. This is. This one. What do you want? That it's just okay. Okay, this is the point being that if it works, if your registry works, you get the mugshot, you get exactly where they live, you get exactly what they did and to what age person. Their height, their weight, their eye color, apartment number. How long he got. The kid was, what, there's somewhere in here it said the kid was 6 years old. All right. And in the live version, it actually now has Google Maps, so you can click and zoom in on the house that the person lives in. Is this right? Isn't this, well, they were, sex offenders were saying, this violates my constitutional rights, that this is double jeopardy, that you are punishing me twice for the same crime. I already did my time. Now that I'm out, why should the world know that I'm a sex offender? Why should they know where I live? And they actually challenged this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to say, that's violating my constitutional rights. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, nope. They said, this is not punishment, that the reason why we're showing where you live and all this is not more punishment. We're not punishing you twice for the same crime. This is public safety issue. The end, you lose. And that was how they ended it, that yes, and this goes on in every single state, known as Megan's Law, to prevent things that happen, like with Megan, in which she was raped and killed by a repeat sex offender, and the parents had no idea a repeat sex offender was living next door. Okay, have a great evening. I'll see you tomorrow.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.